The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to another riveting edition of On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by the Andy Hamilton of Wrestling Journalism. It is Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Welcome, Andy. How are you?
Doing well, Kyle. Yourself?
How could I not be doing good because of the guest we have today? Dan Dennis is going to be our guest today, and I'm very excited about having him on, a guy that we both know fairly well. I think you know him a little bit better than I do from just a great story that you wrote. Let's talk about that story. You wrote a lengthy piece, one that I think you are proud of, that came out before the Olympic trials in 2016, got a lot of national exposure. Take us through the journey in writing that story and some of the aftermath.
Well, it goes back to Dennis making the finals of the world team trials before in 2015, and on the way home from Madison that night, I called him on the way back. I had several hours in the car, and I figured he was getting close to Iowa City. He'd lost in the finals to Reese Humphrey, and we caught up for about probably an hour, just kind of caught up on life, on where he'd been, what he'd been doing. And I think Ryan Morningstar even told me like sometime around there that he had been living in a truck for a while, and then in this trailer out in California and kind of bouncing around. And it described Daniel Dennis to a T from what I knew of him. And so we started kind of chipping away at it. I kind of put that in my back pocket for the Olympic trials. I knew he was going to be a contender in 2016, and there were a lot more layers to that story, and sort of chipped away at it over time. And then as it got closer, I mean, just, you know, the guy's phenomenal to deal with. And I don't know how many times like I would call or text with just little follow-ups here. And some people you're a little reluctant to do that with because they're maybe not as receptive as and cooperative as he was. But stories like that kind of just write themselves.
And it was cool because it had a huge response at the Olympic trials. It was the buzz and everyone was talking about it and great storylines. It had to feel good for you to know that you were having that kind of response at that time.
Yeah, I mean, you like to write the ones that are memorable, that people enjoy, and you know, there's an overwhelmingly positive response to, and that one was that was the case with that story, and like I said, so many different layers to it. A guy that was easy to root for, in that you know, Americans, we love the underdog stories, right? And you talk about his, and he didn't qualify for the state tournament as a freshman in high school, who never won a state championship, had a losing record his true freshman year at Iowa, has that traumatic loss in the NCAA finals in the closing seconds against Jason Ness. And so all these setbacks that he had throughout his wrestling career was not a traditional path for an Olympian. He'd given up wrestling. He'd given it up, and his body was broken down. While he was away from Iowa City, he moved out to California. And I mentioned he was living in a trailer out there that he'd bought with the winnings of a tournament that he won out in Pittsburgh, maybe a year or two before. Got one of those like golf cardboard checks and used it to buy this trailer. Well, while he was out there, he was coaching high school wrestling. And in fact, one of the guys that he worked with was Dom Ducharme, who beat Pat Downey at the U.S. Open. That was one of the high school kids that he worked with out there. And I remember Dennis telling me the night that I drove home from Madison that he goes, "Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to give 2016 a go because of the timing of the Olympic trials." They were in early April, and he wanted to see it through to the finish line with a couple of the kids that were going to be seniors on the high school team he was coaching the next year. And I was just like thinking, man, you got to give this a go. Like, you've got one more opportunity in you, one more Olympic quad in you. You're a legit contender to make the Olympic team. There were a lot of other people that were giving him that same message. And, we all know how it played out with him winding up back in Iowa City and taking a swing at it. And then, making the Olympic team.
I can't remember exactly if you referenced this in the article, but it had an Into the Wild vibe. If you've read that book or know the movie with Christopher McCandless, that was the first thing that came to my mind, because he went out on an adventure and ended up dying in Alaska. But and that's not giving anything away. They actually say that on the cover of the book. But it had that vibe that here's a guy doing something completely unique, completely off the grid, and then finds his way making an Olympic team. It's just an incredible story, and just the journey of it all and how he did it, living out of a truck. I just hope it's something that people will look into that are listening to this, go back and read that article, because it really does touch on a lot of things. One of your lengthiest pieces, I think, and just really a lot of insight into just the human psyche and what we can accomplish if we're given the right opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. And sticking with it too. Right. And I think one of the other elements to this story that made it popular was just, you know, his popularity within that practice room. I mean, he was one of the most popular guys on that team from, you know, 2006, 2007, all the way through the end of his career in 2010. And, you know, I tell you what, I give Mark Perry a lot of credit too. I remember the very first story I wrote about Dan Dennis when he got to Iowa. I remember Mark Perry telling me, and I don't know if this quote made it into the story or not, but Mark would have been maybe a turning NCAA finalist, sophomore on the team. And he said, he goes, he's not there yet. He's really raw. But he goes, this kid's going to be one heck of a wrestler by the time he's done.
And he was.
Yeah.
He reached the finals, two-time All-American, as we said, losing record as a true freshman. You got to see that progression with a guy like him. Did you think this was possible when you first were covering him? Did you think an Olympic team was in the realm?
Nobody thinks a guy that has a sub-500 record is going to make an Olympic team. But you know what's funny is him and Reese Humphrey both had losing records or right around 500 records that year. I mean, I think they battled like in a first-round consolation match at Big Tens. Hmm. And look at the careers that those guys had. And they both bounced back from suffering a lot of defeats. You don't see... You know, there are some guys that didn't go down the same path, right? I mean, that they suffered a lot of losses that first year and never quite recovered from it. I've seen it happen time and again, but to his credit, you know, he bounced back from that. I think the one thing, like a couple of things that I remember about Dennis in the early years, he went out like his first year and he was wild. I mean, like his wrestling style matched his personality. It was this kind of like swashbuckling, go for broke style. And I don't think you saw a Dan Dennis match without seeing a lateral drop attempt somewhere in there. I mean, he tried like 2, 3, 4 of them a match at times, it seemed. And they got that under control, got him, you know, more refined, basic. And, but the one thing that he had early on was just some superhuman strength. I remember that. Like, I remember Mark telling me in the beginning, like, this guy gets a hold of you. And he's like, he's got these big bear paws for hands, and the grip strength was unreal. And that's the thing that you would hear people talk about time and again with him was the strength. You know, when he gets his hands on you, you feel it.
The other thing that struck me with that, too, is that it takes people to prod you along. I think that the Iowa program really were forcing him, not forcing him, but just pushing him like, hey, your career isn't over. Tom Brands, maybe Royce Alger, those were the two that came to my mind as thinking about the article. I like that because you need a push sometimes, and I think Dan Dennis was certainly in that camp. He needed a push to get to that point.
Yeah, sometimes it just takes somebody, you know, believing in you. It takes somebody telling you a message that maybe you've heard, you know, a dozen times before from a dozen different people, but for whatever reason, maybe it's one person that says it, that it really hits home. And there were a lot of people in his corner. You mentioned Alger and certainly Tom, and that relationship, you know, remained strong for a long time there. And you think about the beginning of where Daniel Dennis's career, how it played out in the beginning. And he has that tough year, his true freshman year. Jim Zaleski gets let go. Tom Brands comes in. Joey Slayton comes in at Dan Dennis's weight class. I think there was a little bit of maybe some rocky times in the beginning with that relationship. But then, you know, they got through that, broke down those barriers and found out what each other was about and really connected. And then that's when you saw his career start to really take off. He had broke his jaw early on. He had the rough season his true freshman year. He redshirted his sophomore or his second year at Iowa. And then what would have been his sophomore year, he broke his jaw wrestling, I think, Montel Marion early in the year. So his sophomore year at Iowa, I think only wrestled maybe like one or two matches, and then to step in the lineup his junior year, win the job away from Joe Slayton, who was a returning NCAA finalist. Then also having to beat out Montel Marion at that same weight class, but he took that job and ran with it and locked it down for the last 2 years of his career and won a lot of matches for the Hawkeyes.
Stick around for that interview. We have Dan Dennis coming up later on the program. But Andy, we need to talk about things going on. And I just want to talk about this topic. I love statistics. I just love statistics. And I know you working with trackwrestling.com, there's a great outlet there to get records and statistics. But one of the things that concerns me is that we don't have enough in wrestling. You're a baseball guru. You can go to Baseball Reference. You can go to basketballreference.com. You can go to footballreference.com. I mean, I loved growing up batting averages, home runs. Did they hit 2 for 4? Were they 3 for 5? All those things. I'm afraid in wrestling, we don't have enough of that. And I think we've made so many rule changes, especially internationally, that we don't have a good enough product that you really can compare eras. There's changes in every sport, but wrestling's been such monumental changes that I think it's next to impossible to make comparisons. And we've talked so much about the three period, the ball draw. You can't compare what's happening now with a 10-0 tech fall, or even when it was 15-0. There was a time where it was first to three or three-point must system, where if it was 2-1, you still wanted overtime because someone didn't score 3 points. Now takedowns are worth 2-4 with exposure. It used to be 1-3. So a lot of things change. Times change with weigh-in procedures. But as we look at a way to collectively grow the sport, I think having statistics in a really healthy way, whether it's the most takedowns, I don't even know how we would access Jordan Burroughs's senior international record. I think he's lost 4 times. Nick Marable twice at the Olympic trials the Olympics in 2016, and then Kyle Dake. Those are the only 4. How would anyone look that up, see his senior record? I'd like to be able to have that nearby so that we know what these guys have done. So that's my topic of conversation that I wanted to talk about with this podcast, this show. How do we get better records? Do you have ideas?
I do now. You're in charge, Kyle.
No, I mean, this is your wheelhouse, though. Track wrestling, though. They're part of this. This is part of what they're doing, because they are tracking progress. And I think this is a good thing, because I can go to track and I can see different records. But before that, or just the composite and what it means when there are rule changes and a guy wins 10-0, but then you look back and maybe you're a 10-year-old and you say, oh, Jordan Burroughs won 7-0, 2-1. What does that mean? How have we tracked that? How have we tracked the progress? I think we've done a disservice, especially internationally, in how we track the sport, because there have been just such monumental sweeping changes over the course of time that it really is impossible to compare eras. You can't compare what John Smith did to Jordan Burroughs if you go match by match, because the rules were so different. Even Jordan Burroughs, when we had him on, think about the rule changes he's gone through the course of his career. And he's been going at it since 2011. It's pretty remarkable. And I'm disappointed we don't have just quality statistics, whether it's takedowns, college wrestling, near fall points. I'd like to see us to get to that point. I don't know how we could do it, but I want us to get there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you think about magical numbers and 755. You think about the number 755 and what that meant for Major League Baseball for a long time.
Yeah, still means a lot to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whether you want to put an asterisk by Bonds and what did he have, 762? I don't even know. Yeah. I don't even know the exact number. I think it's 762. But Hank Aaron's 755 home runs, Babe Ruth 714 home runs. Like, those are numbers that, you know, stick in your head. That if I were to ask you, who's got the all time record for college pins, and what is it? Do you know? Who's got the all time record for tech falls in college, and what is it? Do you know?
I could make a guess at the pins. I think there's like a debate on whether this guy named, I think it's Al Sears, Wade Chalice, and Gene Mills. But I think there's controversy over who has that, because Gene Mills had 107 and magically Wade Chalice had 106. So did he pad it with one? I don't know. Just those are all topics of conversation, but I don't know. And there's no consistency. What's that magic number? There's no 5,000 or 500 hits, 3,000 home run, or 3,000 hits, 500 home runs. There's not that in wrestling. It's how many world golds do you have in Olympic medals?
Yeah.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, it's pretty basic. You think about what baseball's doing now. We talk baseball in the office here and some of the high-level analytics and what do they mean. And you think about what they're doing now, even on a television broadcast. You've got exit velocity for a home run. Like, how fast did it come off the bat? What was the launch angle? You watch a broadcast and there's a throw in from the outfield and they've got a gun on it. It shows you how fast the outfielders are throwing it outfield to third base or from outfield to home, how fast the infielders are throwing it across the diamond. You know, what could we have? Could we have stuff like that to measure like how fast like a guy shoots,
yeah,
like how fast a shot is? It'd be kind of cool to see, like, you know, when you talk about heavy hands, how heavy are they?
Yeah,
you know, what kind of pressure is it? I mean, yeah. I don't know how we would ever get to that as a sport, but that would be fun to be able to break it down to that level to understand, like, you know, when Jordan Burroughs fires off a double leg, what kind of force is he bringing with it?
Are we a sport built for metrics, though?
I don't know.
Do you think people could handle it, or fans, or is it just, I don't know if you even want it. I love statistics. It's what I grew up on. And no matter if you like the sport or not, if you hear statistics, 30 points a game in an NBA basketball game, if you average that for a season, you know that's pretty stellar. If you have an undefeated record, that sounds great, but one might be 17-0, one might be 30-0. It just, it's kind of, you have to weigh it differently in different eras. But I don't know if we're a sport that wants metrics. I do. I think we could use it. But again, like to your point, I don't know what it would be. Is it the most takedowns? Is it average takedowns per match? But how do you measure that? Because you can end a match with a fall. So if there's a pinner, he's not going to have as many takedowns in a match. I don't know what it would be, but I'd like to explore it and see what we could get to.
I'm going to put you in charge of this project, Kyle.
You can't do that.
All of our listeners, like, you hold Kyle accountable to this. He's okay. Now the president of wrestling statistics.
It's got to be Jason Bryant. I think that's
okay.
Let's nominate Jason, right? As the president of wrestling statistics. I think he'd be perfect for that.
Our friend Jay Hammond, the late Jay Hammond, late great Jay Hammond, was awesome at this stuff.
Yeah.
And you think about what he was doing in his site, wrestlingstats.com. Well, you know, that'll live forever.
Yeah. That, I use it 3, 4, 5 times a week, if not every day.
Yeah. It's just, Me too. And you think of, I can't tell you how many times, like, I would try to look something up on the internet and look all over for it, and then wind up ultimately sending an email to Jay, and he would know the answer for something that I couldn't find anywhere else. And so we need some people with historical minds and initiative to go do this. And I think we need to build it, I think, collectively as a sport, to maybe push the envelope here a little bit for gathering some of this stuff and housing it in one place. I know Jason's done a tremendous job with kind of picking up where Jay left off, and he's my go-to now when I have questions on a historical sense.
Yeah, me too. And just as we talk through the statistics part, I know that with track wrestling where you work, it was amazing to me that there was a kid that was out here and he said, "Hey, pull up track wrestling. I want to show you my profile." And he said, "Hey, I've beat this kid." And you really can see where people are in the scope of things. So when I ask that question, are people ready for metrics? I think they are. I think they like it. I think they like to be able to compare who's where and who they beat. And I think kids really enjoy that aspect of it. And I've seen that with track, that they have that opportunity to go and see who they've beat and who other kids have beat. And it's very accessible. And that's pretty remarkable, given just it's come on maybe the last 5 to 10 years here. It's a great service.
Yeah, and there's some things that are really helpful for me when I'm cutting up highlights for tournaments. You know, you can go in and check the statistics tab and see who had the fastest pin. And so I'll do that from time to time. And, you know, then, of course, if there's one that gets punched in there for about 5 seconds or 7 seconds, you go right and find the archive match there and watch how it happened. I think that's pretty cool to not have to scour through all the brackets to find every match, especially when you get to some of these big tournaments where there's upwards of 1,000 entrants. But there's some pretty cool things. Being able to go in and see who scored the most match points in a tournament, who's scored the most collectively in one match, or what's the highest scoring match in a tournament? You know, who's got the most pins and in what time, most techs and in what time. But to your point, I think we could all kind of do better as a sport. I think the sport could do better collectively to, house that under one roof and, get to the point where we recognize what those magic numbers are for college wrestling, for international wrestling. What was it? Burroughs won. Did he win like his first 69 international matches? I mean, even like that, even without having to look it up, like who's got the longest winning streak all time internationally? Who's got the most world and Olympic total medals? Who's got the most world and Olympic gold? Who's got the most world titles, most Olympic titles? I don't know that a lot of people in our sport, could rattle that stuff off without having to look it up, like Major League Baseball, home run leaders, Cy Young's 511 wins, Pete Rose with 4,000 hits. It's just, we really don't have those magic numbers yet. And Jason Bryant's mission now.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a few that you can rattle off. Hey, who are the Division I 4-time NCAA champions? You know those guys.
Yep.
You probably know some Olympic gold medalists. Or those
159-0.
Yeah, you know that. There you go. That's those are our numbers. And so we have a few of those metrics, but they're very, very high level. And I've always felt like we diminish other tournaments, that it's NCAA championships are nothing. That you win a Big Ten title, it's just a qualifier. You win the Midlands, it's just a springboard to the NCAA championships. That's a big deal to win those tournaments. Those are big deals, and I don't know how you make them more prestigious than they are. I think we're a championship-driven sport, and maybe that's a good thing, but I think that the composite of a career, you still need to look at these guys that, hey, Mark Perry knew how to turn it on. He only has one Big Ten championship. Only one Big Ten title, but he won two NCAA championships, top three the remaining years. He knew how to get it done when the lights came on, and he's a shining example of that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our guest today, someone very special to us. He also happens to have some good credentials behind his name. 2016 Olympian, two-time All-American for the University of Iowa, reached the finals of the NCAA championships in 2010. Dan Dennis on the line with us. How are you, Dan?
Good. How are you guys?
We're doing great. And it sounds like you're traveling somewhere. What are you up to?
Yeah, I'm actually just on my way to Atlanta to go see an old chiropractor friend and then help out a buddy with the club. So, yeah, I'm on the road right now.
You're known for your traveling ways. Is that something you want to keep doing? Just go around the country and be nomadic?
Yeah, no. I'm planting roots down here in just outside of Chattanooga and starting this club up and just trying to keep good connections and working out different local clubs throughout the summer. So, yeah, just doing that.
You living in a house these days, or are you living in a truck? Yeah. Are you tent, or what is it?
I actually been in a house for a couple weeks now, in Cleveland, Tennessee.
That's awesome. Now, growing up, did you have a proclivity for the outdoors and that type of adventurous lifestyle?
Oh yeah. I was raised in a family that went on vacations of like camping a lot. And, I kind of fell in love with that throughout college and kind of where I find enjoyment outside of the sport, traveling around and taking advantage of that, lacing it in with wrestling too, is the best of both worlds. So fun.
Tell us about Tim and Jane. Give us the profile on your parents.
Well, Tim and Jane, my dad passed a couple of years ago, actually, when I was competing, and mom was a supportive, good mom. She's always been encouraging and everything that I've always wanted to pursue or look at going into. And she's just a great supportive mother that everyone should have.
How do you keep your father's memory alive?
Every day I think you can't not think about your parents, right? And you're always dealt with things that in daily life that remind you of your parents, And I think having one past and that having a close relationship with him, you get reminded of him in little ways every day. So,
what are a couple of those little ways?
When I'm working with kids, it happens a lot where I'm just trying to have a positive impact on something that I used to struggle with that my dad used to try to help me work through. You know, things like that. I try to pass on to the kids that I work with now.
Did he expose you to wrestling?
Well, my neighbor actually got me in wrestling. My dad was always really supportive and sending me places and allowing me opportunities to find good partners and getting better in the sport. So he's really supportive in that sense, but he, you know, he didn't get too involved in my own wrestling. He left that up to the coaches.
Andy Hamilton, who's on with us, wrote a legendary article about you. What was the response to that article when that was written? It was right before the Olympic trials. What kind of response did you get?
Hey, I'm sorry. I lost you a little bit. What was that?
Okay. Andy wrote a great article about you before the Olympic trials in 2016. What kind of response did you get?
Oh, man. The flood that I got after making the Olympic team was absolutely insane. And that's the great thing about being in Iowa. I mean, the wrestling community, the support for the wrestling community in Iowa is like it is nowhere else in the country. It's so strong. And you see... I mean, Hamilton, you do an amazing job with articles that you post out. And the overwhelming response of support. I mean, I know that my sister actually did a GoFundMe for getting our family down to Rio. And it was insane how fast that met its goal and exceeded it, like, in day two. And I saw other people with similar setups, and there wasn't that support. And it was pretty cool, and being a part of that's really humbling, you know. And that's the culture that you got at Iowa, and it's the fan base that we have there. It's really awesome, impressive.
Did a lot of people
get blown away when you see that, right?
Yeah, did they want to know about living out of a truck and all those things that came from that article? Because I know I was fascinated by it, and it was such a great story that got picked up along the way from a lot of major outlets. What did people want to ask you about when they saw you?
You know, just what it's like, the experiences, like, what were you thinking? And it for me, it was all kind of gradual. It's like, you know, seeing a kid grow up. If you're their uncle and you see him once every so many years, you see huge, huge changes from time to time when you see him. When you're their parent or you're around them every day, you don't see those changes as much. So for me, living it, the changes, like, it was all just a natural progression in wrestling. It was just in my life, and it wasn't something that really, like, floored me or anything like that. It was just a natural, this makes sense. The next step is going into California, and I didn't have any money, so it was, where can I live? And the only thing I could afford was in a trailer for a while, and that it just seemed like every step made sense. And the same thing with coming back to wrestling. But having people want to know every little detail and all those steps is kind of, you know, it's flattering a little bit, but to me it's just kind of normal. It made sense.
Is that a lifestyle that you could see yourself doing long term through the end of your life? Is that something you could stick with?
I mean, what's that?
Could you stick with that lifestyle?
I mean, I stick with the lifestyle of dealing with each situation as it is, and just trying to make the best decisions. And, you know, right now I'm opening up a club in Chattanooga. I'm pretty pumped up about that. So really, you know, that's the next step for me. So yes.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, eight years ago, you finished up your college career, was a club coach. Was that something that was in your plans? I mean, as a potential option one day, where did you see yourself, you know, 8 years out of college, maybe?
You know, initially, I went into competing, and I wanted to compete and reach the pinnacle of those goals. And, you know, I wasn't able to fully accomplish that. I gave my best effort and tried my damnedest. And now it's trying to really instill what it takes to get to a high level of wrestling for more than myself. And now it's trying to develop that in younger kids. And now I find a lot of enjoyment in that. And I find a lot of frustration in the little mistakes that I see at a young age, but, it's really fun to work with and deal with now. And I, you know, it's pretty exciting, really pumped up for it.
You mentioned that Rio experience and the GoFundMe page. When you think about Rio, what are the memories that you have and that you'll take from the 2016 Olympics?
You know, I had a lot of friends and family that went down there, and a lot of like really close friends and family that went down there. And, that's really humbling. And it's supportive, you know. That's something that stands out a lot to me. There's a couple of families from California that I just coached for a little bit that I became really, really close friends with. And, seeing, you know, those people come down, my girlfriend made the trip down. You know, my mom and some of my best friends growing up were able to make the trip down. And it was being around them right after competition and not getting what I wanted, but still feeling that support was what stands out most to me.
You took Spencer Lee as your training partner down there. First of all, why? And what kind of feel did he give you? What kind of things did you learn about Spencer during your time in Rio?
Spencer Lee is a really special kid, in more ways than just on the mat. I brought him with me because he's one of the best feels of any foreigner. I mean, if you watch him wrestle, it's pretty amazing just watching him. But actually wrestling with him and feeling some of the positions where he's really skilled, and his background, it comes from his parents with judo and a lot of throws and things like that. And his flexibility he's just a really well-rounded person to bring with as a training partner. And he was either training or reading Harry Potter or playing Pokemon. And it's pretty funny seeing someone who's that big of a badass on the mat. And as soon as practice is over, they're in the room playing Pokemon and reading Harry Potter and that stuff. It's pretty cool.
You got a chance to wrestle him here a couple months ago, right? Around postseason time in March. We've talked about it off air, but maybe our listeners would like to know a little bit about how that went for you. What kind of progression has he made since the Olympics, since he went as your training partner to Rio?
He's continued to develop. Usually you run into those superstars in high school, kind of having a dip or a little bit of a let up or some sort of adjustment time to really set into college and become their own. He just kept growing and developing. The last time I wrestled Spencer Lee, I wound up carrying my own bag of vomit out of the practice room. He is somebody that pushes, and I feel like I'm in pretty good shape and know how to stall a little bit. There's none of that to be done when you wrestle someone like him. He's dangerous at all times, and I got my ass kicked a little bit. The beginning of the workout, I felt kind of went a little even, and then that stayed that way for about a minute and a half, and then it was all him the rest of the workout. It's pretty fun. Pretty fun wrestling him sometimes.
Does being an Olympian open doors for you?
Yeah. I mean, the wrestling community is a really tight-knit community, and there's support everywhere you go. You know, I'm out in Tennessee and just going to the state tournament here, and there's people asking anything they can do, wanting to help out and really grow the sport of wrestling. And you have that everywhere, and they just want to see it become better in every area. So you get that support wherever you wind up going, it seems like.
Going back to your University of Iowa Hawkeye days, you came in as a true freshman. Jim Zaleski was your head wrestling coach, and then you transitioned to Tom Brands. What was that transition like going from Zaleski to Brands?
You know, it was a transition. It was a good transition. Jim is a great guy and a great coach. And I think he did a good job with the situation. And Tom coming in, just, it brought a new dynamic, and bringing Terry there too, just brings in a new energy, right? It that change of coaching, it was, they're both Iowa guys, but there was a lot of energy that Tom brought with it. And, it was rough. It was scary for me personally at the beginning, because there was such a high standard and the intensity level did get elevated quite a bit. And having to scrap with those guys with what they demand is, it only can make you better and tougher, or you're probably not going to do terribly well with your career, looking back at it. But they demand a lot out of you, and to stay the course with them and to keep training the way they want, you can only get better. And it was a big difference for me. I remember wondering if I was going to be able to make it through. And it's something that you have to really ask yourself some tough questions and get through it, you know?
I remember you telling me a story one time that you were wrapped up in how long workouts were going to go, or how long ago was going to go, and you got through that.
Yeah.
What did Tom do to get you through that? There's a pretty interesting story behind this, right? Tom and Schwab helped get you through it?
Yeah, yeah. It was, I remember like it was yesterday. I had this like panic when we would do these long goes and I wouldn't know how long they were, and it would eat at me. And then I would find that I'd be stalling and just wait, clock watching, and I wasn't getting any better. And I made a comment to Schwab about wanting to know how long the goes were. And Tom, very, not so delicately, but very correctly, grabbed me the next day and kind of opened my eyes that that's a meaningless thing to be worried about, and that we're not in control, and that the only thing that I'm in control of during those long goes is how much effort I put forth in them. And that was a big eye opener for me. And I think that was a big step in my training approach. And I remember Tom grabbing my arm and telling me that he would tell me how long every single go was if he could cut off my pinky. And
because you said you'd give anything to know how long they were going to go, right? That's part of the story, right?
Schwab, I was like, Schwab, I'd give anything to know how long the go is. And then the next day, Tom ran up to me, grabbed my arm, grabbed me by the wrist, and was like, that, he karate chopped me on my arm. And he was like, that, would you give that? I was like, damn, Tom, that kind of hurt. He's like, and I was like, what are you talking about? And then he's like, would you give that? I'll tell you how long every go is if you give your arm. I was like, no, I wouldn't do that. And then he was like, how about your hand, just your hand? He was like, no. Then he worked like down to just my fingernail, I think was what he ended it at. And the whole point was that I really wouldn't give anything, because it's silly to, once you really think about it, you're not in control there. You can only control how hard you work. And that was a big eye-opening moment. It was done pretty delicately, too.
So what was it like?
You know, Tom.
Yeah, what was it like going from one brand's brother and then adding another one?
That's kind of what I was talking about earlier, with just the intensity level just got elevated. And that's what it was. And Terry brought that too, you know. And the morning workouts were picking up with just in a different way, from a different angle, with Terry coming in there. He liked doing this with a group of guys in the morning, and then that would just be a different spin on our workouts, you know.
Take us through your progression. You talked about Spencer Lee being all world coming in and just a freshman phenom. You weren't a freshman phenom. You came in as a two-time runner-up, had a losing record your freshman year. You don't see a lot of college athletes make a progression like you had. How did you make that happen? How did you get to the level where you're in the NCAA championship finals after a losing season as a true freshman?
I think really just focusing on getting better the next workout. I used to get really tied up in my head on looking too far down the road, on looking at next year, what the lineup was going to be. I wasn't starting as coming in as a true freshman. I was going to redshirt, but I ended up starting. But the plan wasn't. And it was hard for me to, like, look down the road and see where I would be fitting in, because I just didn't see it. And I really had to do a good job of just focusing on the next workout, not thinking about goals so far in the distance that are unattainable. I just tried focusing on the exact next workout and who my partner was. And that really helps me simplify everything. I think some of these kids today could use that too.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, does what you went through, I mean, you didn't qualify for state as a high school freshman, and Kyle outlined how your college career played out. Does that help you relate to the, you know, the average kid that you work with on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, every kid's in a different situation. I mean, in an extremely different situation. Their skill level, what their abilities are, what their home life is, and what their friend's situation are, and what their school situation are, and all those things have to come into play when you're coaching at the younger level, you know. So I think having to deal with that is something that I think I do a pretty good job with, balancing that all out, and I'm able to relate to. I try to relate to the kids as much as I can, and we're a lot. Everyone struggles in different areas, you know, and trying to think about all those. That's how I try to focus on coaching. And I think in doing that, I do a pretty good job reaching the kids.
In 2010, you reached the NCAA championship finals against Jason Ness. You had the match won, gave up a takedown and back points in the final seconds. Would you just share what it was like the hours after that devastating loss?
It was really heavy. It was really hard. You know, I had put so much emphasis and, you know, obsession on, probably an unhealthy obsession a little bit on that one match. And I didn't deal with it great. The hours right after that were really heavy. I remember feeling like I just let everyone down, you know, and including myself, I felt horrible. And I remember being a puddle of mush, and Schwab coming up to me, he's a coach at the time. And, I mean, I was a ball of mess, and just asking him like why that happened. What did I do wrong? And, he's somebody who had everyone at this level has had a lot of hard losses. And he was someone that was able to relate. He didn't have an answer. And, stupid as that sounds, that was like comforting. And I remember talking with Tom and Terry after, and finding comfort and just talking me through, you know, that they're proud of you and that you've done the things right and that they wish it, you know, that they feel your pain. And, when you're able to have coaches that you can relate to and look up to, and believe and things like that, it helps you get through those times, and it helped me a lot.
There are more NCAA champions walking the earth than people that have made the Olympics for the United States. Did 2016 give you a sense of peace with your competitive career that might have been missing before that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think coming back and I wasn't sure about coming back and ultimately making it to on that team. I mean, I would have loved to have been able to, you know, bring home some hardware for our country. And I didn't have the results there I wanted, but absolutely coming back and feeling like I was able to accomplish something that seemed like it was the next thing to do. And that was, helped me a lot. Kind of make some closure on, you know, my NCAA career. It definitely helped with that. And looking back, it's something that, you know, I'm absolutely proud of.
Do you resent Jason Ness at all?
No, not at all. Not at all. I hear he's actually a great person. And whenever I've been around him, he's always been extremely friendly and And I would love to have 5 seconds back in a match, but you know, I'm not going to be bitter towards him as an individual.
What is it? Just going back to what Andy said, I love that question because, hey, being an Olympian, that's a big deal. And I know that you're driven to reach a high level and you didn't get to that. But how do you quantify that? How do you just kind of make peace in some way about this still is a big deal? Maybe I didn't reach my goal, but it's pretty high up there. And how do you just kind of justify that in your mind?
Putting everything in perspective. I mean, we're in a sport that's ultimately a game. It's in my life, the most important game in my life and in the world that exists. But it's ultimately a game sport, and it's not, you can't identify and fully become like, and let that ruin or make your life. If you're solely dependent as an individual on a sport, I feel like that's not a very healthy balance in someone's life, you know? People go to work and you're able to leave work at work. And, to a degree that needs to be done with everything in your life, you know, and allowing it to consume you to an unhealthy degree, I think is bad, you know?
Are you going to stay in wrestling long-term? Is this part of your DNA?
Yeah. I'm opening up a club right now and, just outside of Chattanooga, I'm going to be working out at the UTC room, and I'm really pumped up for it and trying to pass down and experiences I've had. And I absolutely love the sport and want to share that with the younger generations coming up and pass down as much knowledge as I can to that group, you know. So trying to develop this area, and that's it.
How'd you get so good at a gut wrench?
I had a really good piece of advice when I was in high school, and my high school coach just said, squeeze harder and try to break the ribs. And for whatever reason, that I took that as fact, and I just kept trying to do that harder and harder every single time. And eventually I got pretty good at doing one.
Is that a good feeling when you, you're able to get a guy and you tech fall him and just sequence of gut wrenches?
Yeah. I mean, once being able to control or dominate any match is a great feeling. And, you know, I was pretty happy and pumped up to be able to do that in the Olympic trials finals.
What's highlight for you on the mat, particularly at Carver Hawkeye Arena? 'Cause there's a lot of great memories there. Do you have a match that stands out?
Yeah, I bring up bad ones. I focus on bad ones. I remember, for whatever reason, Jordan Oliver, I got taken down with 2 seconds left, walking back to the center of the circle. I got taken down with 2 seconds left. That wasn't a good one. And then I remember a good one was, I remember wrestling my high school teammate, actually, who was ranked above me, and I was able to beat him in that duel. We had a bunch of high school friends in town to watch that match. And that was a pretty good one. I remember it was a good one and a bad one.
How do you deal with guys who are super quick? You're probably not the quickest guy out there, but you've wrestled some quick guys. How do you deal with speed?
I try to get a hold of them. I'm not the quickest guy out there. And piece of advice I got from my high school coach, again, that I tried to run with as much as I could, was grabbing a hold of an arm and controlling them. And I know I'm not the quickest guy, and I don't like wrestling from space, so I try to get my hands on them and make them feel me. Yeah.
Has there been any point in the last 2 years where you've thought about competing again?
No, I'm too old and frail for coming back and doing that. These young kids will put a whooping on me. You got Lee winning nationals as a 18-year-old kid. You got Dayton Fix pushing Tony Ramos, that's in a barn burner of a match, and I'm excited to watch that one again. I don't know that I want to mess with any of these younger kids anymore.
What's the best thing that Tom Brands has done for you in your career?
Tom, I couldn't name it to one. I talked to Tom yesterday, actually, just about random stuff. He's somebody that I reach out to for advice, and he's always been supportive and arms open and welcoming, and tried giving me as many opportunities as anybody. I mean, he's given me more opportunities than anybody ever has. And I'm forever indebted to him. He's a great guy.
All right, let's do a game. Let's play the name game. I'm going to give you five names of people, places, things. You're just going to tell me what you think about this this person or place. You ready to play the name game?
Yep.
All right, we'll start out with Joe Slayton.
Joe Slayton. Hillbilly, tough hillbilly.
Tough hillbilly. Elaborate on that. What does that mean? I don't know what a tough hillbilly means.
Joe Slayton used to chew tobacco. I don't know if he still does a lot. But he would be one of those kids. I tried chewing for a little bit. It would always make me gag, and I don't know. But I thought it was a tough thing to do. And he was somebody that he'd pick me up, and there'd be a big old chew in his lip, and half of the chew would be floating around his mouth, and it'd be something that would make me gag, and I would just look at him and laugh hysterically. Joe Slayton is somebody that we were at the same weight. I freaking love Joe. I'm going to stick with tough hillbilly on that.
All right.
And I'm allowed to call him a hillbilly because now I'm in Tennessee.
All right. Number two, Tony Ramos.
Tony Ramos. I would say tough competitor. Tough driven competitor.
All right. Number three, Montel Marion.
I'd say about the same as Tony. I've gotten into more scraps with Montel Marion than probably any heated workouts than anyone else in my life, maybe him and Metcalf. Montel Marion was one tough son of a gun. I don't even know the last time I talked to him.
Were you pretty tight with him in college?
Yeah. I Montel and I got along really well. We were really good friends, actually. Right. I'm going to – him and Tony get the same words.
Okay.
Tough competitor.
All right. Number four, Dan Gable.
Dan Gable. He's a legend. Dan Gable is a legend. That's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Did you get to know him pretty well when you were there?
Yeah, he used to make fun of me for folding my clothes. His locker was actually right next to mine. After workout, I remember one day I was folding sweaty clothes and he was giving me a hard time about it. Gable is a very inspirational person and tries to give back as much as he can to the wrestling community. And he tried that as just with me, no different. And he's somebody that I've definitely been inspired a lot by him. And he's tried pushing me a lot too. I have a lot of respect for Gable. I really love him.
We'll end with this. It's not a person, but it's an organization, USA Wrestling.
USA Wrestling. USA Wrestling does a good job. I think they're on top of the world right now. Excited to see how we do next year. I say champions, right?
Yeah, they're going to try to do it back-to-back. Never been done in this country, so we'll see what can happen.
Hey, before we cut him loose, before we cut you loose, there's got to be a Dan Dennis story that's happened in the last 2 years. Like, what's the consummate Daniel Dennis story since Rio?
Since Rio. Probably that I flipped over a bike screwing around. It was riding one of my brother's motorcycles and ended up flipping that thing over, screwing around on some back roads. And I'm still getting made fun of for that one by some friends.
When and where did that happen?
In a parking lot, screwing around, just playing around with my brother and in a gravel parking lot, just trying to do some racing stuff, and ended up high siding the motorcycle and ruining it a little bit. But that's the good thing about bikes, you can always rebuild them.
All right, Dan Dennis, thank you. If you ever need a place to stay, you don't have it with us, you can stay in your truck, so you've got that covered. But thanks for coming on the program. You are a favorite of ours, and we appreciate the time. All the best in all of your endeavors in the future.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. That was Dan Dennis. Great interview. For Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com, I'm Kyle Klingman, You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.